From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a shave, a haircut, or an amputation, we talk with Dr. Ira Rutko about the days of barber surgeons and the practice of surgery before anesthesia and sterilization. Rutko is a surgeon and the author of Surgery and Illustrated History. Also today, Jervi Tervelon talks with us about his new novel, Understand This, based on his experiences as a high school teacher in South Central L.A. Maureen Corrigan reviews The Alienist, the new suspense novel by Caleb Carr. And world music commentator Milo Miles reviews music from Mali. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Italian exit polls are indicating media magnate Silvio Berlusconi and his conservative alliance are leading in the voting for parliament. He's one of Italy's richest men, and he joined the political race just 2 months ago to keep the former communists out of power. The election marks a profound change in Italian politics, which has been dominated by a centrist coalition since World War II. 2 years of investigations involving bribery and patronage have wiped out the Christian Democrats and their socialist allies. More than a quarter of the last parliament have been investigated. Dozens of people were killed today in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thousands of Zulus had marched to protest next month's all-race elections. African National Congress security guards say they opened fire when armed Zulus stormed their headquarters. The BBC's Tom Carver reports from downtown Johannesburg.
Zulu demonstrators poured into the center of Johannesburg from townships surrounding the city. They were heavily armed with sticks, spears, and homemade guns. As they arrived, white and black shoppers ran for cover. The violence began almost immediately. Passers-by were stabbed, and shots began ringing out from all directions. Within minutes, the streets were deserted. The only vehicles to be seen were ambulances and armored cars. Office workers, clutching their briefcases, ran from block to block trying to dodge the bullets. Hundreds of the demonstrators occupied the library gardens, normally a favorite spot for tourists. After they left, I counted 5 bodies. A large group attacked the ANC's headquarters, Shell House, throwing stones and smashing cars in front of the entrance.
Tom Carver reporting. The governors of Alabama and Georgia are touring the devastated areas of their states. 43 people have died from tornadoes and storms that wreaked havoc across the southeast yesterday. More than 20 people died in a church that collapsed when a tornado struck it. Stephanie Mayer is a spokeswoman for the American Red Cross, which has opened shelters in devastated areas. She believes fewer shelters will be needed tonight.
We do have many shelters open. Last night we had approximately 11 opened in Alabama alone. It looks like tonight we will not have quite that many, and possibly we will be down to only about 2 or 3. Because most people have found other places to stay, whether that be with family or friends.
Russia is denying a published report in Great Britain that says it is secretly developing a new germ warfare agent. The Sunday Times of London has said that Russia has what it calls a new super plague powder. The report quoted 3 Russian defectors who say the agent is so strong that just 440 pounds of it could kill 500,000 people. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down 10 points at 3,764. The Nasdaq has fallen 11 to 771. This is NPR. A published report says the Postal Service is backing off on its promise to deliver priority mail in 2 days. The Wall Street Journal reports Postmaster General Marvin Runyon has ordered workers to destroy all unused priority mail envelopes that have the 2-day guarantee message. The service reportedly meets priority deadlines 84% of the time. The Journal says the priority mail system is plagued by problems in tracking and transportation. A postal spokesman says there won't be any guarantees until deliveries are improved to nearly 100%. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees is protesting Thailand's expulsion of about 25,000 Cambodian refugees back to Khmer Rouge-controlled territory. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports from Bangkok.
In her letter, UN High Commissioner Sadako Ogata said the way Thai soldiers expelled 25,000 Cambodian refugees over the weekend was contrary to internationally accepted humanitarian principles and practices. She said most of the refugees were women and children, and since fighting continues in the area from which they fled, their lives could now be at risk. Ogata's protest comes after one lodged yesterday by Cambodian Foreign Minister Prince Norodom Sirivut. He called Thailand's action an abuse of human rights. He was angered that Thailand had not consulted the Cambodian government before sending so many Cambodians back to enemy territory. Visiting Bangkok today, he proposed that Thailand and Cambodia set up a bilateral commission to deal with all future such problems. I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Bangkok.
The U.S. ambassador to Japan has apologized to the Japanese people for a carjacking in the United States that left two Japanese students dead. Ambassador Walter Mondale issued the unusual apology today. He released a statement from President Clinton saying the American people deplore this senseless act of violence. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A lot of us might be dead if it weren't for life-saving surgical techniques. But it wasn't too long ago that surgery was as likely to kill you as save you. Imagine how dangerous surgery could be in the days before antiseptic techniques, when there were no antibiotics to clear up post-operative infections. And consider how painful surgery must have been before the creation of anesthesia. My guest Ira Rutko is a surgeon who has written several books on the history of surgery in the United States. His new book is even more comprehensive. Surgery, an Illustrated History, begins in ancient Mesopotamia and ends in the 20th century. One of the things I was interested in was the phenomenon of barber surgeons. About 1,500 years ago, barbers were fixtures in monasteries where they trimmed the beards of the clerics. In that era, in Europe, clerics, in addition to their religious duties, performed primitive surgery.
By around the 10th century, the Roman Catholic Church made a decision that the clerics should not be involved in health care at all. Prior to that time, the clerics, because they were the most educated people within the continent, were involved in giving health care and, in fact, performed operations. So the only people who were then able to perform surgery were the barber/surgeons. And that is how barber surgeons came about. We're not talking about anesthesia. We're not talking about antisepsis. We're talking about people who really were performing functions which today for you and I would be removing a splinter or perhaps having, if you have a boil, incising it. That was what surgery was back then.
Well, why were the barbers trained in surgery?
It wasn't so much that they were trained in surgery. It was that they were there at the time, sort of like a lucky break. They were the only ones who saw the clerics performing surgery in the prior centuries. So naturally, it grew up with them and their families that they learned how to, and they actually took over the profession of surgery. If it weren't for the barber surgeons, surgery would not exist today as we know it.
Well, how far did barbers progress in the field of surgery?
In different countries at different times, they progressed right along the mainstream of surgery. And in fact, in certain countries, they actually became the surgeons that we would regard today as the modern forerunners of 1994 surgery. It really depends on what particular country you're dealing with. In England, for instance, the barber surgeons were very powerful. And eventually, they assumed control of the Royal College of Surgeons throughout the 16th and 17th, and well into the 18th century. The barber surgeons were very strong. And what happened eventually, in about 1750, the Royal College of Surgeons, which was actually called the Royal College of Barber Surgeons, split. They decided that the barbers were no longer integral to surgery, and the barbers were sort of shunted aside, and a new class of individuals arose, and they were the surgeons.
So was there a time you could go to the barbershop and get a shave, a haircut, and an amputation?
Oh, you ask an interesting question. In a men's barbershop, especially when I was a youngster, there was always a barber pole outside,
mm-hmm.
and it had a red and white thing that used to be circling around, electric motor.
The barber pole.
The barber pole. Well, the barber pole was a throwback to the barber surgeons, and they used to hang a towel outside their shop that was red to represent blood and white to represent cleanliness. And that was how the barber pole started.
What was it like to perform surgery in the days before anesthesia? Anesthesia was first invented in the mid-1800s, but there were right. there were plenty of surgical operations performed before that. How complicated were those operations? And maybe you could give us a sense of what it was like to do it without anesthesia.
It was not a very pleasant experience. And one of the most graphic discussions of the entire pre-anesthetic surgical literature involves a mastectomy that was done on a member of the royal family. Actually, she was a noblewoman in England in about 1820. And it's quite graphic. She explains how the surgeon removed her breast with a knife without any anesthesia, how they were screaming and the pain that was involved. It was not a pleasant sight. It's very funny, though, when you look at pictures of surgery prior to 1840 where things are depicted, it's very uncommon to see the patient struggling and screaming. Yet, I can't imagine as an individual in 1994 having somebody amputate my leg or my arm, let alone a breast, and not squirming and screaming and moving around. Yet all the pictures depict very placid patients who are calm. It's something that I've never been able to understand as a historian of surgery.
Do you think they were drugged?
They attempted to drug people. They had opium derivatives and other things. I mean, opium was something which had been around for many years. Obviously, they were not narcotics. They did not have cocaine and morphine and things like that. But there were attempts to give people, let's say, liquor. Alcohol was used, but it wasn't really all that effective. It's hard to imagine that if you're drunk and you're going to have your leg amputated, that you're not going to feel pain.
Maybe they passed out.
Often they did pass out. If you read the descriptions of surgery from the Renaissance on up through around 1850, they talk about having four or five holders, people who would have to hold the patient down. But you must understand, surgery was something that was a last resort. It was not therapy as we think of it today, where if you have, let's say, a gallbladder that's bad, that it has to be removed. You have little choice. If you have appendicitis, it has to be taken care of. Otherwise, you will die from it. Back then, very often, the therapy was worse than the disease. Getting operated on was not a lot of fun.
Well, you point out in your book that in the days before anesthesia, a surgeon was prized if he could work very quickly.
Yes, yes. Well, like we said, if you're going to have your leg amputated and you don't have anesthesia, and you are the patient, I think that you want to go to the surgeon who moves the fastest. It behooves you, in fact, to go to the surgeon who moves the fastest. So that very often, the surgeon would walk in, and it was, I mean, common knowledge. The surgeons were very stern figures, and they would wear their coats. Tell you that they used to wear the same coat from one operation to the next. You know how nowadays we wear different gowns and we throw them away, or they get re-sterilized or whatever? Back then, they would wear a black coat, almost looks like a tuxedo coat, a formal dress coat, and they would walk into the operating room. They would do the amputation, wipe the bloody knife on their coat so they would remove the blood, put the knife onto the table where it would lay for the next case, whether that was the next day or the next month, and the coat they would hang up and would have all your blood on it, and then a month later when they would do the next operation, they would put the coat back on, and that's how they went about doing things. But regarding the speed of the operation, it behooved the surgeon to operate fast. They had to. They had no choice. So that a surgeon would very often tell the audience, time me. Watch how fast I can do the amputation. And there are many records that were set. It's amazing how nowadays we think of surgery as something which is very precise and very orderly and something which is done very diligently. Back then, and I'm talking again in the 17th and 18th centuries, they literally would do an amputation in 40 seconds.
Wow.
Yes.
This is before power tools.
we're talking about one entire sweep of a knife down to the bone.
Wow.
I don't want to sound gruesome here, but they would go down to the bone with one sweep around your entire leg or arm, and they would take a saw and cut off the bone, and the amputation was done.
Gee, you know, I'm thinking how really bloody surgery must have been in the 17th and 18th century before there were clamps for blood vessels.
It was very bloody. And clamps were something which really did not come about until the mid to late 19th century when surgeons such as William Halsted in Baltimore, Johns Hopkins, and Theodore Coker in Bern, Switzerland started using them. They would do operations where you literally have pictures of maybe 100 to 150 clamps at a time in the operative field that they would then clamp blood vessels with and have to tie off to stop the bleeding. What happened prior to that, though, was they used to take a mass ligature. They would take something sort of like a piece of silk, a string, and they would just tie everything all at once. They would include the blood vessel in the arm, the nerve in the arm, the vein in the arm, and just tie everything. And what would happen over the course of time, 2 weeks later or 3 weeks later, after infection set in, you must realize that infection was something which was considered part of being operated on. It was called laudatory pus. And that laudatory pus was something that they wanted to happen. They wanted you to get infected. Of course, they didn't realize it was getting infected. In retrospect, we realized it was getting infected. They wanted that to occur.
Laudatory is a praise word.
Yes.
Why did they think the appearance of pus was good?
Because they didn't understand that it was bad.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is historical perspective. You must understand history. And we're talking again about something which happened 300 years ago. So they thought that it was natural for this exuberant or laudatory pus to happen, where literally buckets and buckets of pus would fall off of somebody's wound.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Ira Rutko. He's a surgeon and author of the new book, Surgery and Illustrated History. Most of the period that you write about covers the years before doctors knew anything about microbiology, before they understood infection and how it could be prevented during surgery.
Yes.
So did most wounds get terribly infected? This was typical?
It was not unusual that the patients died from operations. For instance, let's take the Civil War. The Civil War was one of the major calamities in the history of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And yet from this major calamity, there was much which came out of good, and meaning particular surgery. There were literally thousands, tens of thousands of amputations that were done on a daily to monthly to yearly basis. I have a picture from a battle, I think it's Antietam, where there's a picture of severed limbs, both arms and legs, literally a pile of 20 of them, and it says, a day in the life of a surgeon in the field. When you got shot in the limb, or if you even broke your extremity, back prior to the time of Lister in 1870 and antisepsis, the common treatment was to do an amputation. It was expected that if you were shot in the, let's say, the upper arm, that you were going to have your arm amputated.
To prevent terrible
infection? To prevent infection from setting in, because that you would get gangrene and you would die. Now, the problem was that in doing the amputation, which again they would do in maybe a minute and it would be done, they would take a hot burning iron and put it to the end of the amputation site to sear the blood vessels to stop the bleeding. Of course, that would cause infection. So as a consequence, and no one really knows the percentages, but the wounds themselves, the amputation sites, ended up being infected. And I would say that you're looking at an infection rate of maybe 75% to 80%. Maybe 1 in 5 people did not have an infection from their operation.
Were a lot of surgical procedures performed under pretty dirty conditions because doctors didn't understand that dirt would lead to infection?
It depends what you mean by dirty conditions. Compared to what we know today, obviously it was very dirty. Compared to what they thought at the time, they thought they were being clean. Their idea of cleanliness was, again, walking into the room, taking the knife, which was bloody from the prior operation, dipping it into water to get off the old blood stain, and then going ahead and doing the operation. Because they just had no knowledge at all in terms of infection, in terms of antisepsis. It was something which didn't occur to them. So if something doesn't occur to you, it's very difficult for you to imagine at that time, in 1850, that it's dirty. Dirty didn't exist to them.
How was it discovered that microorganisms breed infection and that there was a way to prevent infection?
The entire concept of microorganisms and infection was not something that happened overnight. There was a gradual evolution, and this evolutionary process really took many centuries. But it all culminated in around the 1840s and 1850s in Germany and in France, by individuals with the name of Pasteur and Claude Bernard and Virchow and other well-known people within the fields of medicine. It was never initially surgeons who found out that organisms were causing infections. That was something that Pasteur and other individuals, Robert Koch, that they did. What happened was that in England, Joseph Lister took up the concept of microorganisms causing infection, and he finally put one and one together and got two. And that's how, in the 1870s, we began to realize that antisepsis and cleanliness were the most important things that a surgeon would need to prevent infection.
My guest is Dr. Ira Rutko. He's a surgeon and a historian of surgery. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Ira Rutko, author of the new book Surgery, An Illustrated History. You have an illustration of a cesarean section.
Yes.
That's performed, and I forget what the year is, but it's centuries ago.
It's in the 16th century.
I was really surprised that C-sections were able to be performed that long ago.
Well, C-sections were performed, of course, back to ancient Roman times. There are some people who say the reason they're called cesarean sections is that Julius Caesar was born that way.
Huh.
Now, whether that's apocryphal or not, no one really knows. But C-sections have been around literally for 2,000 years, and they were not done with the sophistication that we have today. And very often the mother died from the actual operation to save the child. But C-sections are not something which are new. They've been around for many times. There are certain operations, and we can go through them. C-section is one, the removal of stones from the bladder, hernias, another operation on the brain called trephination, where they drill a hole through the skull and attempt to remove blood clots, or back then, if people thought that there were, a disease within your brain, they would drill a hole through your skull and let the bad vapors evaporate. Those were the most common operations that were done back then. In those operations, hernias, the trephination on the brain, C-sections, and lithotomy, removal of bladder stones, have followed up through the last 2,000 years. And you can see the sophistication of these as they grow.
In earlier days of surgery, were surgeons respected?
Respected, of course, is a relative term, but certainly if we think of surgeons and doctors as they are in America in 1994, the answer is absolutely no. The respect for surgery did not occur, at least in this country, until the 1880s and 1890s. That's really when surgeons came about. It's very interesting if you read some of the literature from the mid to three-quarters way of the 19th century in the United States, there was really not a group of individuals known as surgeons. Back then, everybody was a physician slash surgeon.
Mm-hmm. Well, you write about how in medieval times, a medieval surgeon stood in jeopardy of losing his life if he operated unsuccessfully on a feudal lord. And there was an edict that stipulated that the surgeon whose patient died should be handed over to the family and the patients, so that the family could do what they wished with the surgeon.
Absolutely. And the wise surgeon back then did not operate that often. I mean, he only operated when they knew that they were going to get the patient better. It's not uncommon that there were stories where surgeons were killed operating on somebody because of a death resultant from that operation. And it's not only that the surgeon might have died. If they operate on, let's say, a patient for a cataract or for a problem with the eye, and the operation was not a success, well, what happened was that the surgeon would have his eye removed. And it sounds a little gruesome, but that's what used to go on. And that's really why a branch of surgery called itinerant surgeons came about. Itinerant surgeons were individuals. They were not in the class of barber surgeons. They were another group of surgeons. They would go from town to town. That's why they were called itinerant. They would perform an operation, and it's said that prior to the bad results actually occurring, the itinerant surgeon was gone
right from
the town, so that they couldn't do anything to him.
Huh.
And that's how
before the days of malpractice, it sounds a lot worse.
Oh. I'm not sure what's worse, getting hit for malpractice suit of $1 million or losing your arm. They're both very difficult situations.
What was it like the first time you observed an operation?
Well, I will confess that the first time I saw an operation, I fainted. And I was about 15 years old. I had a cousin who was an ear, nose, throat surgeon in New York City. He took me into the operating room. He was going to do a rhinoplasty. Somebody's going to have their nose fixed. And I remember very distinctly, to perform that operation, they had to break the bone in the nose to remodel it. And the last thing I remember was the room getting sort of circling around me, and I wasn't able to hear much, and I was on the floor. It was embarrassing as a 15-year-old who wanted to become a surgeon.
Well, how come you stuck with it after having such a bad reaction?
Well, I always enjoyed surgery. I think surgery, there are personality types that go into particular fields in medicine, and surgery tends to look for a definitive answer. I consider myself to be an obsessive compulsive personality. That's why I write. And surgery provides an immediate answer to a particular situation. It's different than treating somebody with diabetes or emphysema, where the treatment literally goes on for years into decades. Surgery, you have an answer. You go in, You open up a person, you remove the disease, and the patient gets better, hopefully.
Now, what about the first time you performed the operation?
The first time I performed the operation, well, it was 1975. I was an intern, and the attending surgeon, this was up in Boston, said to me, well, I think that you're going to do the hernia today. And I looked at this gentleman, and I said, what? And I remember very distinctly, he said, well, you better go read about it, because you've done enough of them that you've assisted now, and I would like you to start. And it's a nerve-wracking experience. The first time you take a scalpel in your hand and realize that you're going to have to cut into another person's body to relieve them of a misery that they have. It is something which you have to learn to do. It is the rare individual that it comes easily to.
Do you have a very steady hand?
I have a steady hand, yes. But it's not something that I would tell you that happened overnight. I've always had steady hands. But I've never seen an individual yet. It's very interesting. Whenever you operate with somebody who's new, or if you have a new nurse in the operating room, whenever they touch an instrument, they start shaking at the beginning. It's very scary to cut on another individual.
Oh, I'll bet it is. I don't doubt that at all. Do you ever get over that?
Do you ever get over it? I think that surgery is something that you never get over, the mystery of it. I think it's a wonderful thing to be able to take care of another human being and make them better. And I think that you have to approach it that way each day and not lose sight of the fact that you're operating on somebody who is another human being and that you want to get them better. But do I ever lose that? No. I think it's something, and I don't think that a surgeon should lose it. I think you have to be cognizant of what you're doing on a daily basis. If it becomes rote and the person doesn't mean anything as a human being, then you might be in the wrong field.
Have you ever had surgery?
Yes. Yes, I had my appendix out when I was 19 years old.
But you haven't had surgery since becoming a surgeon?
No, I've never had surgery since I became a surgeon. And I would be lying to you to tell you that I would not be scared. I would be scared of getting operated on. I think that it's natural. I think that any person that I see in the office who tells me that they're not concerned and not scared, I think that they're lying to me. I think it's natural to be scared. Surgery is one of the greatest things that we as a race, as human beings, have been able to do, that we can cut into another person, relieve that misery, the mystery that's inside there, make that person better. It's essential to the flowering of all of human existence.
One last question for you. Do you ever play music in the operating room?
No, it's funny that you say that, because I go into operating... When I was in residency, I used to go into operating rooms where surgeons would always have music on. And when I write, when I operate, when I do anything, I have to have silence. Not that I mind talking, but I don't like having music on, particularly when I operate and when I write. I never have music, and I love classical music, but I don't listen.
But a lot of surgeons do.
Oh, absolutely. I go into operating rooms where other surgeons are on, and there's rock and roll blasting and whatever.
Is that disrespectful, or is that okay?
I don't think it's disrespectful. I think that if it makes the surgeon feel at ease within the milieu of their particular operating room, then I think it's exactly what you want. You want your surgeon to feel most comfortable with what they're doing on your body.
Dr. Rutko, thank you very much. It's been fascinating.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Dr. Ira Rutko is the author of Surgery, An Illustrated History, published by Mosby. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Coming up, teaching high school in South Central L.A. Jervy Tervelon has written a novel based on his experiences as a teacher. He had to work hard to get past the students' stoic attitudes. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews The Alienist, a suspense novel set in late 19th century New York City. And world music commentator Milo Miles reviews vocal music from Mali. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. South African police and witnesses say there's been total chaos on the streets of Johannesburg today. Reports say at least 28 people have been killed in the city center and outlying areas. The unrest began with a Zulu march in the city. African National Congress guards fired into a crowd of Zulu demonstrators in the worst incident. The Zulus allegedly tried to storm ANC headquarters. One witness says he saw at least 9 bodies. Some Zulus began attacking nearby pedestrians in retaliation. Several Zulus oppose next month's elections. They say they'll be excluded from power by the ANC, which is favored to win. After a string of setbacks, Israeli-Palestinian negotiations for peace are scheduled to resume tomorrow in Cairo. But a new eruption of violence in the Israeli-occupied Gaza Strip is creating new doubts about whether the talks will proceed as planned. Miriam Hirschlag reports from Jerusalem.
The latest violence followed a procession by members of the militant Fatah wing of the Palestine Liberation Organization. Army sources said 6 Fatah members dressed in military fatigues were returning to their home in the Jabalia refugee camp in 2 cars, and that undercover soldiers called on them to halt. When they did not, the soldiers opened fire, killing all 6 Palestinians and wounding 2 teenagers nearby. The army sources said the 6 dead men had all been armed with either semi-automatic guns or pistols. Palestinian sources at the Jabalia camp, one of Gaza's most poverty-stricken and volatile spots, say that in the wake of the clash, the mood is near boiling point. For National Public Radio, I'm Miriam Hirschlag in Jerusalem.
Playwright Eugene Ionesco has died in Paris. He was 81. Ionesco was born in Romania, but spent most of his life in France, where he founded the avant-garde theater of the absurd. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Eugene Ionesco broke all the rules in theater. His plays don't have plots, and the dialogue is often meaningless, reflecting his view of the futility of human existence. His first and best-known work is The Bald Soprano, which was first performed in Paris in 1950. It's about 2 married couples who sit around exchanging banalities. The critics panned it, but Ionesco said he was encouraged by their response and continued writing. His family moved to France when he was 1 year old, but he later spent some time in Romania. He was extremely critical of human rights abuses in communist regimes. His later works focused on death, which he called our main problem. And although he believed in God, he once said, "The world is a joke. God has played on man." For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
New Jersey health authorities are trying to prevent a giant outbreak of measles at Rutgers University. Officials are trying to track down about 40,000 students and staff and get them inoculated. On Wall Street, stocks closed lower today. The Dow lost 12 points to end the day at 3,762. This is NPR. The mayor of Edison, New Jersey, is opposing plans to reopen a natural gas pipeline that triggered an explosion last week in a city apartment complex. Mayor George Spadaro says he'll meet today with officials from Texas Eastern Transmission Corporation. That's the firm that operates the pipeline. Spadaro says it's premature to reopen the pipeline this Wednesday. He says Edison officials are ready to go to court to stop it. A company spokesman says Wednesday is only a rough estimate and that the firm won't do anything without coordinating with the mayor. This is the 15th anniversary of the worst commercial nuclear power accident in the nation's history. Ed Ark of member station WITF in Harrisburg reports residents of central Pennsylvania haven't forgotten the Three Mile Island accident.
At 4 a.m. on this date in 1979, the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island in suburban Harrisburg officially began. Early this morning, nearly 100 people were outside the plant's gate to commemorate the anniversary. Anti-nuclear activists held a low-key demonstration beginning with a moment of silence to mark the time the incident began. At the time, the accident appeared to be a major setback for commercial nuclear power. And while the damaged reactor has been shut down since the accident, another reactor continues to operate at the site. Also presently, the Nuclear Energy Institute reports 109 nuclear energy plants generate 20% of the nation's electricity. For National Public Radio, I'm Ed Ark in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
Two Japanese automakers say they'll increase their purchases of U.S.-made parts. Toyota says it expects to buy about $1.5 billion more in parts than it does now. Mitsubishi says its Illinois-based division is expected to double its purchases. Both firms say they are estimating and not promising their purchases. The news from Toyota and Mitsubishi comes one day before the Japanese government announces new steps to open the Japanese market. Those steps are not expected to work well. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Fashion changes in popular music are impossible to predict, but often seem obvious after they happen. World music commentator Milo Miles has a review of a woman singer named Umu Sangare, who is a rising star with world music fans. He says her style of music, called Wasulu, sounds designed for our times.
Mali is famous for its griots, troubadours who sing about famous people, tell history tales, and offer social commentary. Many of these are women, and the accompaniment is often no more than a harp-like instrument or a gourd xylophone. The southern region known as Wasulu, however, boasts a particularly potent lineup of instruments and a group of young female vocalists who reflect some of the sleek drive of Western pop in their delivery. The most sensational of these neo-traditionalists is 26-year-old Umu Sangare. She has two albums, the earthy Musulu and the new Kosira with a larger band. Both are grabbers. Sangare's voice is the hypnotic highlight of her songs. Her elastic rhythmic tension gives her a very sensuous swing, and her abrupt declarations have the kick of a blues shout. And her backup chorus are soulful sisters indeed. But the texture of Sangare's band is why Wasulu bids to become the world music flavor of the day. The combined pulses of the electric bass and six-string harp are neither fast nor slow, just brimming with forward momentum. The down-home violin solos by Aliou Traoré mark him as one of the funkiest of African folk musicians. Even newcomers should find the arrangements meticulous, firm, yet intricate. Might even call them organic. It must be noted that Western fans of Sangare will have to pick through her ideas about traditional culture for women in Mali. She has declared, "I am here to support women. It's time women's voices were heard and their contribution recognized." She denounces faithless men and does a good job dramatizing the struggle between rural convention and urban modernization. Yet in the song Sigi Kuruni, Sangare seems to endorse a marriage system in which a woman is no more than a servant to every male in the village, as well as her mother-in-law. The song's refrain goes, "This is the little wedding stool, a little stool for sitting on." Now, inferring nuances from a translated lyric is always a dubious undertaking, but this sounds bitterly ironic to me. I'd like to think so anyway, because everywhere else, Sangare sounds quite sly and insightful. After all, how many rock stars could get to lines like these? "Death spares no creature. Nothing can stop it. Not even fame."
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. Umu Sangare's albums are on the World Circuit label, distributed by Rounder Records. This is Fresh Air. Jervy Tervelon grew up in South Central L.A. He left the neighborhood to go to college, but then he returned to teach high school. His experience teaching is the basis of his new novel, Understand This. He says one reason he wrote the book was to try to show the kinds of choices young people have to make in the inner city, where school competes for their attention with drugs and guns. Tervelon is currently a Hollywood Pictures screenwriting fellow at Disney Studios, and teaches fiction writing courses at the University of California at Santa Barbara, where he went to college. In Understand This, the point of view alternates between the teacher and his students. This passage is told from the perspective of one of the brightest students, Margot. The teacher, Michaels, has handed her a stack of photocopies of magazine pictures. One picture shows a woman holding a skinny baby. Another shows young people smoking crack. Margot figures Michaels is trying to tell the class something about AIDS.
Michael seems to think since he's the only young black male teacher at Boat, he's got to do the right thing, save the race and all that yang. Only reason he thinks like that is because he's from the West Side and he didn't go to a school like this. People are stupid because they want to be stupid. Like, how could somebody do it without a rubber? You see, these strawberries walking around with it, skinny as a skeleton, smoked up, dried up, sprung. You know, it's not just from the rock. Lots of fat bass heads. Somebody feeds them. It's got to be AIDS. Michaels ought to teach English instead of preaching.
I think one of the first things you want to do when you're a teacher is to make sure that the classroom is a safe place. Did you think that you had the power when you were teaching to, you know, guarantee your students that they were protected while they were in your class?
I tried to as much as I, you know, could. I mean, as much as possible. I tried to make an environment that was it was conducive to learning and also to just courtesy. I didn't tolerate students insulting each other or being crude to each other. I, you know, tolerated high spirits, but not, you know, viciousness. Unfortunately, there is a tolerance for violence in our society, and there's a tolerance definitely in our city for behavior that's that makes it impossible to do things, complex things like teach Shakespeare or teach a sonnet or read a novel by Toni Morrison, because, you know, some students can be disruptive and it only takes one or two and then the classroom is in, in chaos.
And if a kid is disruptive, what power do you have to deal with it? Can you send them out of the room? Do they care if they get sent down to the principal? What could you do?
Well, really, a lot of it depends on the school system and the principal and also the teacher. Some teachers, even in spite of what the principals might do, run their classrooms as a tight ship. This is one incident that kind of typifies the kind of frustration one encounters in a classroom. I had a student insult me in front of other students. It was a very large, angry woman and a young woman, and she cursed me out. And, didn't accept it. I took her out of the classroom. I told her, you know, you're not going to get away with this, and you're out of here. So anyway, I sent her down to the dean, and he suspended her. Now, this is almost at the end of the semester, so grades are coming and everything. I was told, but I didn't want her to admit her. Again, I said, I'm through with her. She's not coming back in my classroom. They told me unless I pressed charges against this young lady, I had to admit her. So either I could send her to jail for threatening me, or I, you know, would have to admit her back to my classroom and have her scare the hell out of my students.
Did you have students who you knew were carrying guns to class?
No, I didn't know of that. I felt that the campus I taught at, Locke High School in South Central Los Angeles, was a fairly safe place. My students were respectful of me in general, and I thought were protective of me to some extent. We didn't have that kind of hostility, and I don't think it was even a racial thing. I think some of the teachers I was friends with, some of the white teachers, they felt the same way, that they got along with the students. But the problem is that you have outsiders. You have people that want to get onto campus to do things, to harm the other students or to disrupt things, or students that aren't particularly interested in being there but show up to disrupt things because, you know, that's what they do. That's their job in life.
Okay, one of the characters says about the teacher in the novel, Michael seems to think that since he's the only young black male teacher at Bold, he's got to do the right thing, save the race, and all that yang. Do you think people thought that you had that attitude, that you felt like you had this larger mission to save the race?
I think that particular student might have thought that because she, I think, was aware of her position in society, and she didn't really care for it. The Margot character is a... You know, it's somewhat bitter. I mean, well, she is bitter and she is angry about her life. And I don't think that she would be much different if she lived on the West Side or she grew up in Pacific Palisades. She's just like an intelligent, self-aware young woman that is just pissed off at the constraints of being a teenager about to become a woman and or an independent woman. So I think her angriness reflects on Michael's because he has a kind of enthusiasm that she finds to be kind of dangerous to have. You know, if you're enthusiastic in inner city about things, then, you know, you must either be a minister or a fool, you know, because people, you have to watch your butt. You don't know what might happen. You have to maintain a kind of hardness, you know.
You know, speaking of that, I've even noticed that, like, so many of the rappers have this almost sullen look on their faces all the time. I can think of no better example than Snoop Doggy Dogg. I mean, you know, like there's just never anything that registers on his face. It's just always kind of glum, you know?
Well, you know, actually, I find I find Snoop Doggy Dogg, his appearance sort of endearing. He reminds me of people I grew up with. And, I don't find him threatening at all.
I'm not saying he's threatening. He looks like a guy that
probably would be very pleasant to have a hot dog with or, a hamburger.
No, but I'm not even saying he's threatening, just that he's kind of like glum. And
well, exactly. He's maintaining that hard face, that exterior. I think to the outsiders, it does, you know, people that didn't grow up in that environment, it looks glum. But, you know, if my mother saw him sitting on the couch, if he were one of my friends with that expression on his face, she would say something to him like, why the hangdog look? Why so glum? Snap out of it, you know? It's so fake. It's like, it's amusing. At Ice Cube, another rapper that I kind of grew up fairly close to, he perpetually scowls.
So do you think that part of that scowl is a pose that a lot of people have?
Yeah, it's there for the public consumption. And, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, you know, I remember watching John Coltrane and the Miles Davis quintet on some TV show and just how serious they looked. And I realized it was in reaction to It was in reaction to how Dizzy Gillespie looked, you know, his kind of zaniness, his craziness. You know, I am nobody's fool is what they were saying. Take me seriously. They, I think, tried to show that they were serious and that they had decorum because they wanted people to pay attention to music. I think that with somebody like Snoop Doggy Dogg that essentially kind of lifted George Clinton's work, The Atomic Dog, wholesale. I mean, I think what he wants you to do is not pay attention so much to music, because he knows that is going to disappear in a hot, you know, second. He'll be yesterday's news, yesterday's lunch very soon. He wants you to pay attention to him to give legitimacy to his music.
One last question. I'm sure you'd probably like it if some of your former students read your new novel, but I'm wondering if you think many of your former students read much, only because, you know, I hear so much about young people not really reading anymore.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, I think the reading is just taught so poorly in the schools. I brought in Hemingway short stories. I would bring in a story like Hills Like White Elephants, and I would highlight the man's voice and the woman's voice and hand it to my students and have them act it out. And eventually they'd realize it's about abortion and the situation between a man and a woman, and I would have them write the ending of it. And then I would have them read Up in Michigan, or I'd have them read Rose for Emily by Faulkner. And what I found out was the students would say, this ain't real stories. Or, you know, some of the students that were really, you know, not particularly literate, they would say, that's not real. That's not a real story. You made that up. And I would, you know, like, be very flattered that they would think I'd, you know, make these stories up by V.S. Naipaul and Hemingway. They were astonished that the stories were interesting, because what we give them is the Pearl. We give them, you know, Steinbeck's The Pearl, which, you know, I think is fairly insulting to, you know, Latino students anyway. But we give them work that just doesn't have that visceralness that the students want. These students have lived complex lives, and we give them stories like The Scarlet Letter, a novel to read like that. And it's not so relevant to their lives. So I think it's important to read The Scarlet Letter, but I also think it's important to read things that, you know, that are vibrant in their, in what they present in the way of complexity of life, that sort of thing.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Jurvi Tervelon's new novel is called Understand This. This is Fresh Air. The southern states are still reeling from tornadoes. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have on All Things Considered?
We talked to a volunteer firefighter in North Georgia, Terry, who told us some stories of things that he had seen and people that he had met who had also met the tornado on yesterday afternoon. We also will be covering the shootings in Johannesburg, where there are elections starting today in Uganda. We'll be covering that story. We're back at Taft High School in Chicago to hear how they think Goals 2000 will affect them and how carpooling will affect us all as the Clean Air Act goes into effect, requiring employers to do something about too many people driving into work.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The hero of Caleb Carr's new suspense novel, The Alienist, is an alienist. That's what psychiatrists were called in the 19th century, because they studied mentally ill people who were thought to be alienated from the rest of society. Critic Maureen Corrigan has this review.
Think of The Alienist as a macabre companion piece to Martin Scorsese's recent film of The Age of Innocence. Like that movie, The Alienist also ushers us into the glittering, cinematic world of late 19th century New York society. But if The Age of Innocence focuses on one man's heroic struggle to repress his libido, The Alienist explores the consequences of another man's failure to repress a more diabolical urge. In The Alienist, Edith Wharton meets Hannibal the Cannibal, and The Age of Innocence is transformed into the age of horrific experience. The novel opens on a quintessential dark and stormy night in the late winter of 1896. A New York Times crime reporter named John Schuyler Moore is rousted out of bed by his friend, the renowned alienist Dr. Laszlo Kriesler. It seems the mutilated body of a young boy has just been discovered on a catwalk of the Williamsburg Bridge, which was then under construction. Moore and Dr. Kriesler have been called in to solve the murder, which isn't the first of its kind, by the newly appointed police commissioner of New York, Teddy Roosevelt. Rounding out this odd investigative team are a policewoman wannabe and a pair of Jewish police detectives who dabble in the new technique of dactyloscopy, or fingerprinting. Besides Teddy Roosevelt, the investigators also rub shoulders with other real-life Gothamites, like Jacob Riis, J. Pierpont Morgan, and the notorious birth control banning censor of the U.S. Post Office, Anthony Comstock. I'm usually wary of plots that take liberties with historical characters, but as surreal as events sometimes get in The Alienist, Carr always convinces you to willingly suspend your disbelief. Part of his power as a storyteller arises from his eerie visions of old New York. Here's a snippet from the opening chapter where our narrator, Moore, describes racing in a carriage to the scene of the crime, the unfinished Williamsburg Bridge. An elaborate maze of steel supports below the roadway bore us dozens of feet up into the night air. I began to make out what looked like the walls of a large Chinese temple suddenly looming ahead. This peculiar edifice was the Manhattan side anchor of the bridge. In a way, though, my impression of it as a temple was not far off the mark. This new roadway was a place where many workers' lives had been sacrificed. What I did not know was that the blood sacrifice that had been made on that particular night was of a very different nature. Carr describes turn-of-the-century politics, dinner menus, and tenement life with equal authority. But apart from its educational value, The Alienist also offers up an old-fashioned, cliff-hanging, page-turning plot. As our detectives frantically use their primitive knowledge of forensic science and psychiatry to try to trap the killer, bodies pile up all over Manhattan. But even though the murders here are grisly, the fact they take place during the Gilded Age means squeamish readers like me can rest easier at night, comforting ourselves with a late 20th century lullaby litany of anti-serial killer forces, the FBI, the CIA, and America's Most Wanted.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Alienist by Caleb Carr. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Nancy Greenlees and Sue Spolin. Research assistants from Louisa Shafia. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Mel White ghostwrote books for Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and Billy Graham. White didn't tell them he was gay. He hardly wanted to admit it to himself. But after aversion therapy and exorcisms failed, he came out. On the next Fresh Air, we'll discuss his new memoir. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.